All right, I'm recording.
So am I.
How many times? Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex. The other guy who is pretending to record is James.
Hey.
Hey, how's it going? I would say that before we get started, I would tell you what we've got coming up, but we're recording this a few weeks before this is going up. This podcast is actually going up, so I don't know what's coming up. So you'll just have to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com.
You have to.
Yeah, exactly. Or you could just, well, I won't say the other option because I don't want to encourage that. Also follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men, all one word. Also be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes. And while you're on iTunes, be sure to give us a positive review, because reviews help us to be seen and or get noticed, I guess.
It
And not a
hurts.
lot of people have noticed us yet. No matter how many single tweets we get from Judd Apatow, the people have not caught on yet. So, but yeah. So yeah, I guess I'm pretty excited about this episode. So let's just hit the theme song and we'll get right to it.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex again. With me is James. What are we talking about here today, James?
The films of Rian Johnson.
Oh yeah.
The wide catalog.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a wide catalog. It's about to be a bit wider.
About to be 50% wider.
I guess. Or does it become yeah, I suppose.
At least film-wise.
Yeah, I've never maths were never my strong suit, to quote or paraphrase Tom Hardy in Inception. But yeah. He's got two movies, a couple Breaking Bad episodes, an episode of Terriers, and a pretty sweet Mountain Goats music video. But we're just going to focus on his two movies today, Brick and The Brothers Bloom. Right?
Yes.
That was our plan. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, good, because that's what I'm prepared for.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So.
Ryan with an I. Let's get that out of the way
Yes.
first and foremost.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he's a writer director. He wrote and directed both of these movies. We'll start with Brick just because that was the one that he made first.
Yes. Yeah, I think it came out in 2005 or 2006. I should know this.
You should know this.
Yeah.
You're a professional podcaster, man.
I feel like professionals get paid. 2005.
Fact.
Yes.
Yeah, but he was trying to get this movie made for a while, right?
Yeah, it was written in 1997, and they didn't shoot it until 2003. And I mean, he had just sort of come out of film school, or I think he got out of film school at some point in the 90s. I couldn't
96.
96. Oh, okay. Yeah, and he Rian Johnson didn't do work on film immediately. Like his cinematographer and DOP, whose name I am forgetting, so I'm gonna just scroll down here and look it up. Steven Yedlin or Steve Yedlin, who they met, I believe they met in film school and are good friends, or maybe they knew each other long before that and have always been making movies together. Don't quote me, but anyways, Yedlin worked on actual film sets, and Rian Johnson was writing the script. And once Johnson finished the script to a point where he was happy with it, Yedlin would just sort of carry it around with him on the sets that he was working on. And anytime he'd sort of run into a producer he thought was cool that, you know, might sort of get what Johnson was getting at. With the script, he'd hand it to them, and eventually just sort of got out there, and they were able to secure very little financing, but financing enough to make the movie. On the director's commentary, Johnson says it was just under 500,000. I've read 475. I've also read 450, so somewhere in that range. And they did it sort of just by quote unquote passing the hat, which is basically asking people to contribute money so they could make their movie. And I think visually, I think this movie looks way better than the budget it has. It's a very impressive movie for that budget. But also, that allowed them to sort of have no restrictions. Like the less money you have to deal with, the less fewer financiers you have, the more freedom you get, basically. And again, on the director's commentary for the movie, Rian Johnson said it was sort of like not having any adults around while you're at summer camp. And they were free to sort of do whatever they wanted, and we got Brick out of it.
Yeah, you feel it worked out well, eh?
I'm a big fan of this movie. I think I don't think it's like there are certainly things in it I find problematic, and generally I don't think it's super strong thematically, but just to watch it is so entertaining. And I think it's funny when it tries to be funny. It's suspenseful when it tries to be suspenseful. Just the filmmaking aspects of it are really, really impressive. The cinematography, the music's great. The performances are great. This is one of my favorite Joseph Gordon-Levitt performances.
Which is saying a lot.
Yeah. Well, I think he's
your
got...
boy.
He is my boy. He doesn't have as many performances that I really, really love as you might think, but this is definitely one of them.
Well, until Looper comes out.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. He's looking like a Thunderbird
actually,
character.
Yeah, we'll talk more about Looper later, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I have a question for you, just because you touched on a lot of things you did like about this movie, so I kind of have a bit of an answer already.
Mm-hmm.
You have always talked about how you like movies that just try something new.
Yes.
And
I think I've specifically referred to this movie as something that made me very excited just for trying something new and sort of like, oh, this is a new voice. This is something I haven't felt before, like watching a movie. And then I just get really excited and send you a bunch of text messages about it. And then you wait 5 years and see it.
Okay. So what is it about? First of all, this is kind of a multi-part question. Uh-huh. What is it about this movie that is new, or what is it new that this movie is trying that you don't see in other movies up until then?
Well, I mean, the big thing, and this is, you know, the most notable thing about the movie is that it's a combination of noir, or the noir set in high school. And that's sort of the thing that hits you immediately. Like, I recognize two things in this, and those two things are now together, but I've never seen them together before. I don't think this is the first noir set in high school. I feel like there was something in the mid-80s that came out that I haven't seen. But yeah, this was certainly the first thing I saw, and also just the dialogue was so distinct, and the way the camera moves in this movie, it just sort of felt new. It felt like there's Fincher in there, there's Wes Anderson in there, there's Scorsese in there, but all at the same time, and also like a lot of the Hollywood Renaissance as well. So I don't know, just it's weird because I know breaking down Rian Johnson's movies thematically and just the ideas of them, I don't find anything that's totally new in them. But I feel that they're still extremely creative movies, and yeah, just I don't know, like, because I mean, we delayed the podcast, this podcast, a few times, so each day, like before we were supposed to record it, I watched these movies again, and so I've seen them like 5 times in the last week and a half, and no problems with that. Like, they're just, I just particularly, and really with Brick, I just love I love the process of watching it. Even if there are sections of it I don't even like, I just, you know, I really enjoy watching it and would watch it again right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
I guess that wasn't the best answer to your question, but it's just sort of like the amalgamation of all of these things that are done well in these movies, the way they combine is the thing I haven't seen before. It's not any specific new idea. It's sort of the combination of all these things together into something that flows well and feels new.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's what I was going for. And I think particularly with Brick, even the people who don't like it, that's they worded a lot differently than your responses. Whereas the people I've talked to who don't like this movie, of which there are many, I mean, of the people who have seen it, it's not a very widely viewed movie, but I think of the people who have seen it, it really does split people.
Okay.
People really like it or they really don't like it, I find.
Yep. Well, like I haven't gone out of my way to recommend this movie to a lot of people. Just sort of people I really know their tastes for.
Yeah. And so it's the combination of the kind of the noir and a contemporary high school movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like noir is so dated, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but there was about 15, 20 year span where noir was so big. And then we do still get noir movies every once in a while. I mean, we've done a podcast on Chinatown, which is kind of a neo-noir.
And a big influence on Brick as well.
Yeah, and No Country for Old Men, people call neo-noir. But it's interesting because it's one of those genres that when we see a new one of it, it's called neo-noir.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, when we see new action movies or a new Western, we hear neo-Western and neo-action much less often.
Mm-hmm.
And so with Brick, I feel people see this very distinct genre in it and then see it set in this high school setting and, you know, contemporary high school even. And so that strikes people right away.
Yes.
And even the people who don't like this movie are quick to point out in a negative way that, you know, people will say maybe this movie's trying too much or pretentious as a movie. I think a lot of people who dislike this movie would attach to it.
Yeah, a word, pretentious is a word. Yeah, I've heard definitely attached to
yeah.
this.
And so my question was, like, is it how much of this movie, how much of your appreciation of this movie relies on the fact that it is doing something new or at least combining old elements into, you know, in a formula that hasn't been seen at least a lot before? Mm-hmm. And how much of it is really the execution of that? I feel like if I had seen this movie before you had and, you know, told you to see it without even saying that I liked it or disliked it, if I had just told you that it was a kind of like a 40s noir movie combined with a contemporary teen high school movie, you would probably just watch it based on that alone, right?
Yes.
Yeah, just because, you know, you like teen movies and you like things that try something new. I don't think you're big on noir, but just the combination of something you like with something so separate from it.
I like the noir genre. It's just sort of that I don't watch a lot of them because I feel like, I don't know. But yes, I do enjoy them. I've seen very few of them. Like, I've seen The Maltese Falcon, and I love Chinatown, but that's more of a neo-noir anyways. But yes, I generally agree with what you're saying.
Okay. But for you, this goes beyond that, right? Like, it's more than just the premise of these two things combining. You think the actual execution of everything is done very well.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. To mix two genres, this is a pretty interesting combination, right?
Yeah. Like I said, I hadn't seen it before Brick, so yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and well, what is it about those two genres that you think are such a kind of an odd matchup, but work out well?
See, I don't know, and it's not. It's hard to explain, because like I just don't have an explanation for it. It's just sort of like something that seems crazy to read, but also just sort of works. And I mean, it's kind of a cheat because I know Rian Johnson's explanation of it, because when he started writing this movie, his initial idea was just to make an American detective movie. He had read a lot of novels of Dashiell Hammett, who wrote Maltese Falcon, and he just sort of wanted to make a noir movie. But he then added the high school thing just because he felt like everybody knew the conventions of noir. And he felt that changing the visual cues of the movie by basically applying a very, very fairly standard noir story in high school, he could keep the story conventional and the movie would still be interesting because the visual cues have changed to the audience. And it's just sort of like, you know, there aren't a lot of people in hats or anything like that. The femme fatale is harder to spot initially. But otherwise, it's a fairly just straight up noir movie. And yeah, I mean, that's the best thing that is the best types of things that are combinations of, you know, older things are the things that change things slightly, but still keep the what initially worked about them in the first place, like the mystery aspects or everything being told from this one character's perspective, which is like Chinatown, which we've brought up already. Every scene in this movie features Brendan. So it was Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character.
Yeah, and like most detective movies, we watch him learn and we, you know, learn everything right along with him and are piecing things together at the same time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, what I thought was interesting about these two genres combining is teen movies are always, I think more so than pretty much any other genre, are so obsessed with what's new and current and being contemporary. And, you know, teenagers, I think more so than most groups, what's cool and the way they speak and, you know, what's trendy and the way they communicate changes so quickly. Mm-hmm. So in order to make a good teen movie, one of the big things you need to do is make sure you get that. The language down is always a big thing because there's always new slang and things like that. And this movie completely goes around that by taking, you know, 1940s and 30s slang and running with that. Yeah. And as I said before, noir is, it is so dated, and it's, you know, people are always updating it with these new noirs that we already talked about, but it seems so old all the time. So I think it's that combination of a genre that is so stuck in a time period 50, 60, 70 years ago and combining it with basically a very new genre, considering teen movies, as we know them, pretty much started in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And even beyond that, every time we get a new one, it is so obsessed with being current and new.
Yeah, particularly modern teen movies are, definitely.
Yeah, exactly. And I think to me, that's what makes this such an interesting combination of things.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Well, we're talking about high school. I guess I've got a question for you. What do you feel like, what do you think this movie says about the general, like, the most common perception of high school, like the hierarchy of high school, like the cool kids and all that stuff? Do you feel like the noir figures are sort of, or the noir conventions are sort of applied in a way that is sort of meant to say something about the hierarchy of high school?
I didn't take it that way. Again, we've said it, these movies really don't do much for me thematically, and there's not much there. And that sounds like an awful thing to say about a director, but I love this movie a lot.
Yes.
And I've liked it a bit more every time I've watched it. I don't get the sense that there is some commentary in there. I just think it is a very well put together story and an extremely enjoyable thing to watch.
Okay.
That being said, I think it's interesting how well they do line up mm-hmm. with, you know, a criminal syndicate lining up with the cliques of high school very well. Mm-hmm. I find that very interesting. I don't know what that's trying to say, if it's trying to say anything, but yeah, I love how this looks, you know, so many things just line up with the teen movie genres while also hitting noir film genres and genre conventions, I mean. And yeah, that's what's interesting to me. As I said, these are such different genres that when you see things line up and make sense like this, obviously they're made a bit more dramatic in this movie yeah. than my high school experience yeah. was.
But, I imagine you laughed a few more
times. I find that to be absolutely fascinating about it. And yeah, I think noir is always so wrapped up in murder and betrayal and things like that. And high school, I think, is high school films and I think people's high school experiences are so over dramatic and, you know, highly dramatized that it's an interesting combination. And then you throw in the drug dealing story, which is the big story
yes.
of this movie that we haven't even mentioned, because I think when people describe this movie, they again fall on the genre description of it and don't even mention that it's about drugs, which is what it is about very much.
And the title is a reference to a break of heroin. So,
yeah, exactly. And I just think that kind of gets put in the passenger seat because this very interesting thing that they do with noirs, you know, is really what people notice right away and really what makes it different than other movies like it.
Yep, definitely. I do think the movie says a little bit about the hierarchy of high school. I think that sort of framing Brendan as the outcast, just sort of what I've picked up about Rian Johnson. I feel like the character that is the most like Rian Johnson would have been in high school is either Brendan or the Brain. And I, whether or not this was a conscious decision or not, it just sort of feels like a pro outcast culture type of movie. And yeah, no, I'm fine with that. I fit more into that than I do to Brad Bramish, you know what I mean? As much as I love Brad Bramish in this movie.
Brad Bramish with the B on his letter jacket.
Coach has got to put him in the game though. Let's just be real about it. How can he do how can Brad Bramish do
football team?
What?
But no athletes in our school were making those speeches in the parking lot.
How many of your athletes were cokeheads? I feel like that's implied in the movie.
That probably would have helped,
yeah.
Eh?
Yeah. But yeah, no, it's I don't think the movie is trying too hard to say something about high school. I think it's trying to make a light point, but I think the general point of this movie is just to make a good entertaining movie, and they succeeded. And a quote I found very interesting about the way high school is perceived in the movie is that Rian Johnson says that Brick, as far as, you know, it pertaining to an alternate reality, it's sort of like an alternate reality. It's like a hyper, you know, a changed version of reality. He likens it to what Gotham is to New York City. Brick is to high school. And
okay.
Which I think makes perfect sense. He also goes on to say that Brick isn't the way that high school was, but it's sort of the way it felt from being within it, in that everything sort of feels more mythic and more serious when you're actually there, because you're not old enough to realize how silly the things you care about are. And I mean, these are more bigger things like heroin and dead pregnant girls, you know, like
yeah,
these are bigger things. But just from Brendan's perspective, him trying to get Emily back, like that's sort of what I really feel like that quote is, can be applied to. And and that the way applying the noir conventions to that sort of add this sort of mythic quality. And I think that is kind of a decent way to put it, that it's sort of how high school feels when you're in it, you know?
Yeah, I know. And I think that they do an interesting job of making a teen high school movie be dramatic without being, you know, OMG over dramatic, yeah. You know?
Yeah.
And yeah, obviously, as you said, when people are slinging bricks of heroin and killing dead, killing pregnant girls, mm-hmm. there's obviously going to be an elevated level of drama, but
it's pronounced drama.
It's deserved this time around. Yeah. And that's one thing I do appreciate about this.
Yeah.
Sorry. Like you were talking about Rian Johnson, and we haven't mentioned it, but this movie was filmed at his high school.
Yes. In San Clemente, California.
Yeah, and as you said, he's been working on it for years before it came out, so he wouldn't have been in high school when he was working on this, but he would have been much younger when this idea really came to him and he started working on it.
Yeah, well, I mean, like we said, he wrote it in 1997, so let's say even if he had the idea well, he certainly didn't have the idea of applying high school to it until later, so let's say like 1997. But yeah, no, he was certainly out of high school, and I think he said out of film school as well, so yeah, he's far removed from high school.
Yeah, but what importance do you give, like, the fact that this is shot in his high school?
That it's his high school specifically, I don't give a lot of importance to. I know that the reason they did it was because of how little money they had. Also, it works. Like, it's a decent-looking high school for what they need. And it's also sort of that they didn't have a lot of money. They didn't really have a lot of money for sets as well. So it was just sort of like the easiest thing that they could do. And I feel like they could probably fudge some of the paperwork on permits, shooting permits here, just because it's his hometown and he probably knows a lot of people. But yeah, and he said that his familiarity with the area really helped when they did get kicked out of locations. He knew instantly where the next best spot to shoot that was. And right. So I think it really was a convenience thing more than it was anything to do with the script. I don't think it was like when Sylvester Stallone's like, I'm not selling you the script for Rocky unless I get to play Rocky. I don't think it was, I'm not giving you the script unless we shoot it in my high school. I think it was just sort of, you know, just the way filmmaking, you know, you have to deal with within your financial realm. And this was something that was in their realm financially. I'm sure there were right. a lot of favors given to Rian Johnson for this.
Yeah, no, I would think so. And for a movie that does look, I mean, this doesn't look like an expensive movie, but this doesn't look like a cheap movie either.
No. And
so for him to pull this off at less than $500,000, which is a lot of money, but when shooting a movie is not very much money at all,
yeah.
It looks very good.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And I mean, there are numerous indie film tricks in this movie to keep it on budget. Like there's a lot of the action takes place during the day, saves you on lighting. But there are also things that seemed like crazy complicated for what they were pulling off. Like all the dolly tracks and just Rian Johnson likes to keep the camera moving at all times, or not at all times, but very often. And some of the shots in this movie are just so complex and interesting and just really quick moving dolly. And just doing all those setups must have taken so much time. And his crew is clearly very impressive.
Yeah. Well, my take on his high school thing, and maybe it's not as important that it is his high school. And I agree with you that I don't think this was his goal to make a movie in his high school, and that it really was probably more convenience and budget. But this is kind of one of the thematic things that I do find interesting about this. And I think this movie is a bit of, I guess, a power fantasy, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Brendan in this movie, and as you said, he's kind of our stand-in for Rian Johnson.
Yeah.
That's fair?
Yeah, if we have to pick one, then yes.
Okay. Well, in this movie, Brick is about Brendan getting something done despite being an outcast.
Yeah.
It's not, that's not all it's about, but that's, I think, a true statement about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he's an outcast. He's a loner, but he's very smart.
Yeah.
And he's very, you know, cunning and brave. I mean, standing up to everyone he stands up to in this movie and getting very deep into something that he really is not wrapped up in at all. He kind of just chases his way into it.
Yeah.
This is not a problem that really concerns him, but then he finds out his ex-girlfriend's involved and then just kind of runs it down from there.
Yep.
So to me, it's kind of just about the intelligence being more important than, you know, strength or status or appearance and all the other things that seem so important in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And he manages to transcend that. And he gets to the bottom of this with intelligence and persistence. And as I said, he kind of transcends all these other social groups and what they have. And, you know, Brad is a strong, popular guy. And, you know, I love that fight scene, by the way.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
I know we've discussed that.
The staging of those shots is just so cool to me.
Yeah, and just the fight alone. I mean, he's obviously much smaller, much weaker, but just kind of uses, you know, a couple cunning little tricks to end up winning that fight.
Yeah.
And to me, that's kind of probably the way, you know, Rian Johnson managed to be more successful than people in his high school who, you know, were probably ranked above him socially while they were in school.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had things like, you know, strength and status and good looks and, you know, whatever else makes you important in high school.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he was persistent enough to just, you know, pursue what he loved and was smart enough to be good at it. And I just find that interesting that it's in his high school that he's kind of living out a life that he's put together through all these traits that weren't really valued in high school. And, you know, now he's really making something of it. And now he's, you know, by the time 2012, he's making Looper, which is, you know, a big budget Hollywood film. And he hasn't had a stellar box office record, but, you know, I'm sure he's happy with where he's ended up at this point.
Yeah, I mean, he still has he has a very impressive amount of creative control still. And I think I was just reading an interview with him about Looper where I think the Looper budget was something like $60 million. And so instantly I was just thinking like, oh, he probably didn't have that much control. But in an interview he said, or sorry, he probably lost a little bit of control to get that $60 million. But he said something like, I don't know, he made it feel like it wasn't a huge budget action movie and a, sort of more of an independent thing, and that they sort of just raised, found a way to get that money and still keep control. But anyways, yeah, I see your theory. I do see that in the movie, and I think I've been listening to Rian Johnson talk a lot recently, and I just feel like that seems a little meaner than how Rian Johnson would want to write something. But I do agree that the general idea you're positing definitely exists in the movie.
Yeah, no, I don't think he decided to make a movie in his high school to be a fuck you to anyone who's ever bullied him.
I'm going
to
teach Brad Bramish.
Yeah, I just find it, like, I can't imagine him being back on his old, like, back at his old high school. That must have been so surreal. And, you know, I just think the way that he has managed to become successful is very similar to the way that this main character, who's something of a stand for him, manages to achieve his goals in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which kind of leads me to my next question. What is Brandon's goal? What is driving him in this whole movie? And is he successful?
What starts it is just that he still cares about Emily. That's all it is. And then he's just sort of, he wants to solve the mystery of who killed her. And then he's just sort of too deep to just walk away. I guess sort of like split up into three parts. This is a 100-minute movie, let's say. And the first, you know, 35 minutes or so, it's he wants to make sure Emily's okay. He still seems to want to be with her. She's not dead yet. She dies in the opening minute. Like, we see her dead in the opening minute, but then we flash back to 2 days previous. And, so he cares about her initially. And then it's sort of, well, I want to know who killed her. And then he sort of thinks he's got that piece together, but he's still not out of his own situation. So he's just got to keep going until he can get out of it. He also sort of wants to make sure that the blame is pinned on the right person for, no pun intended with the pin. but the blame is given to the right person. And he's not entirely sure it's Laura until pretty clear to, or pretty near to the end. So, his goals change throughout the movie, but they're all sort of based off of him caring for Emily and wanting to make sure that people that did her wrong pay for that.
How do you like their relationship? And
You mean
phrase
Emily,
your answer with a particular focus on the line, "You're the only thing I ever loved." And was that too emo for you, or is this one of those ones where it's kind of surrounded with enough quality that that line works?
I'm fine with that line. I think that might actually be the exact moment in the commentary where Ryan Johnson's talking about it, brick isn't the way high school is, but it's the way it felt. And I think that's if that's not where he said it, it's one of the places it most makes sense for him to say it. Because yeah, I that's, very very over the top, but do your thing.
Well,
It's
high
not
school is over the top,
Yeah,
so.
exactly. It's not my favorite line, but I think it works in that scene. It works fine. There aren't things in this movie that really take me out of it. I totally buy this world.
Okay. You've touched on it a few times, saying that there are entire segments you don't like or things that really don't
Sorry,
work for you.
by me saying entire segments, there are parts in this movie. There's about like a 30, maybe 30 minutes is a little much, but there's a stretch of this movie in the second half that I just sort of always just find myself sort of zoning out and just sort of focusing on the visuals for, which could be a credit to how good the visuals are in this movie, but could also just sort of be I just sort of lose my patience with the noir story. And I do feel like this movie could be a solid 10 minutes longer and not have lost my attention, which seems weird. But I feel like just a little bit more space in between some of the plot points could have been better. But in general, like I remember the first time I watched this movie, I fell asleep in the second half. This was years and years ago, but I was like, "Oh my God, the first half's amazing!" And then I finished my sandwich and fell asleep. Yeah, and I still wanted to watch it again, and I did, but it took a while before I really cared about the whole 100-minute length of this movie.
Okay.
So I think that's sort of just still residual of me watching this when I was less smart and less interested in going with these things.
Yeah. Do you feel yourself empathizing with Brandon a lot?
I don't know. I don't know that
Like, I just mean because it's so elevated, as we've talked about, it does it take you too far out of the high school thing for it to be relevant, or does it still keep you?
No, it's I don't find myself thinking with a lot of emotion attached to this movie. Like I don't cry when Emily dies or anything like that. I don't really feel much throughout this movie as far as emotions, but just sort of I really enjoy this movie and it might not connect with me emotionally, but I don't think that's a negative necessarily. So no,
Okay.
I'm not particularly attached to Brendan. No.
Okay. Have you talked to a lot of people who don't like this movie?
I haven't talked to a lot of people that have seen this movie, so no.
And the people you recommend it to, you're usually pretty sure are gonna like it or at least have patience for this kind of thing?
Yeah, I think I'm one for one. So yeah, I cannot stress how few people I've recommended this movie to.
Okay, because I talked to someone who had seen it, and not on my recommendation, but had seen it before we met. And then it's someone who we have a similar taste in movies about a lot of things, and then are very split on some things.
Okay.
And this is one of the ones we're absolutely split on. And they always said, "Oh, this movie is trying to be something it's not. It's so pretentious. It thinks it's so much better and deeper than it really is." And you can see why this would split people, right?
Yes, not hard. Not hard to see that.
Yeah. Any other movies you can think of that split people in this way?
Oh God, no, I'm sure there are tons, but not off the top of my head. Probably
Okay.
most of my favorite movies.
Okay. Yeah, well, my experience with this movie, I've seen it, I guess, 4 times now, and I think I like it more and more every time.
Okay.
And it kind of worries me to watch it again because I kind of like liking it this much.
Okay. You don't want to risk it.
Yeah. Have you kind of maxed out? Are you
No.
like it as much as you're ever gonna like it?
See,
Or is it getting better or worse for you?
there aren't a lot of movies Because when I watch movies so many times, now my focus of how I watch them just sort of changes to more of the filmmaking aspect. So I, when the story stops being interesting, then I focus on the cameras and stuff like that, and just the way the movie's put together. And I haven't run out of things to look for in movies yet. So lucky me, I guess. But yeah, no, I have no problem rewatching movies. If only, like, I'll look for new things. That's always sort of what I'm looking for after the first couple times I watch a movie. Once, you know, I've sort of ingested the plot and the emotions of the movie, I just sort of, I look around, and I like doing that. So no, I have no problems with the idea of watching this movie again. I'm not worried about it.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have anything else you want to say about Brick?
Yeah, yeah.
I have a couple more things, but it's relative to the second film we're talking about and comparison.
Okay, cool. Yeah, well, we'll just keep going with Brick. I like the way Brennan's feet are focused on a lot in this movie. He's sort of all throughout the movie making these very calculated steps, very precise steps, and I mean that, you know, not with his feet necessarily, but sort of just throughout the plot, like how he's sort of planning these things out and then following through, and they're all sort of very specific things. And then we get a lot of close-ups on his feet, and his feet move in a very precise way when in any of these close-ups, and just sort of the way he's sort of like dragging his foot along the curb when he's walking along it, seeing Emily's dead body. I really like that. Just in general, I like how his feet sort of work for how he's walking through the movie. All those close-ups. And also, we have to talk about the chase scene real quick. I just love it so much.
Oh, yeah.
The chase.
Wow, I can't believe I didn't.
Yeah. No, the foot chase scene in this movie is just one of my favorite action scenes. And that's it. It's just so creatively staged. The sound is amazing. And I just love it.
It's all sound.
Oh, it's like, all sound.
So much. It's very little physical confrontation. And a lot of it you can't even see both people at the same time, which is usually such a trademark of chase scenes. Obviously, this guy's here and this guy's here, and oh, the gap's closing or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas this one, you see so much of him and then the other one, and very, very few times do we see them in the same frame.
Yeah, it's great. And also, just a quick note about that. That was the first thing they shot on the first day. So Rian Johnson's feature film career starts shooting that scene. And I think that's crazy.
Good.
Yeah. And just sort of for the... I'll point out a point about Brennan's jacket. This is sort of something I was thinking about and then was proven correct through the director's commentary. Because we don't see Brendan in his jacket in the flashback, and we don't see it after he gets out of the Pins house towards the end. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt has a very specific posture in this movie. As Brendan, he's got, you know, he's always really hunched over. He's got his hands in his pockets, and his hair is covering his forehead. And it's just sort of like, this is sort of the shield that he puts up. And it's sort of like a post-Emily shield. And this is how he wants to protect himself. And I think it's sort of an interesting sort of, way to deal with heartbreak, I guess, which we see him deal with heartbreak in that flashback. The quote you mentioned was, "You're the only thing I love, and this is how I do it." And he's not wearing his jacket in that scene. His hair is off his forehead, and he's sort of like very exposed in that scene. And this is the jacket, and the way he starts walking after that is sort of very... him guarding himself, him dealing with his own heartbreak. I like that. That's probably the jacket, oddly enough, is the thing in this movie I find the most emotional attachment to, which I guess is part of Brendan. But and then in the final sequence in the field, he doesn't have the jacket on. His hair isn't like it was before, but it's not covering his face as much as it has been in the movie. And then he's sort of talking to Nora, finds out that the kid was his, or at least it's heavily implied. And I guess my question is, for that last scene where Brendan's standing there in the white t-shirt, the jeans, watching Laura, that's her name, right? Laura? All my notes, I have her Nora because that's her, the actress, but... yeah, I think it's Laura. Anyways, when he's sort of watching her walk away, and then the last shot of the movie is him sort of finally turning away, what is he looking at when he sees Laura walk away? Because it is this really prolonged thing, and it has to mean something. It has to be more than just watching Laura walk away.
Yeah. I think it's just him being left behind once again.
Okay.
And that's... I'm just trying to remember this exactly because it's a still shot and he's and it's just her walking and the camera doesn't move with her, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. And she's like, by the last time we see her, she is less than a percentage of the frame.
So. Yeah. Well, and this was one of my like introductions to caring about film as a medium at all is we watched Ordinary People. Have you seen that?
No, I never have, but we've talked about it before.
Yeah. And there's a scene, oh, spoiler for Ordinary People, by the way. someone near the end of the movie drives away from the house of the main character. And the camera doesn't follow them up the driveway. She just goes out of frame and the car disappears out the right side of the frame.
Okay.
And my English teacher, this English teacher who I really liked a lot, said very briefly, oh, kind of in the language of film, and this was not a film-heavy course, it was just a straight English class, but we watched one movie, I forget why. She said, in the language of film, if the camera doesn't follow it as it leaves, it's gone for good. Like, if something escapes the frame without ever being followed at all, then it's gone. And that was my first, like, I liked movies at that point, but that was my first kind of foot in the door that there is a language here. There's something deeper that I'm just, that pervades cinema that I just don't understand yet.
Yeah, okay.
And this was before going to film class and university and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. This is still when you saw movies as just novels with visuals, basically.
Exactly.
That's something you've told me before, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, just a recorded play of a reading of a book.
Yeah.
And that sticks with me, and I can't think of any other moment that I can see as, like, a spark of my appreciation of movies as much as that one.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I see something like that, that's still what it is to me. It's, you know, it's not necessarily just that, but every time I see someone do something like that in film, it still brings me back to this person is gone, not coming back. We're still in the position of the character that's left on screen. And it's just it's a shot of pure abandonment. And as we've seen throughout the movie, he's very much alone. He gets help from Brain, but we don't really get much of an emotional attachment between the two.
Yeah.
They seem to have some kind of mutual use for each other.
Yeah. I remember that in, like, I can think of people that I was very specifically had, like, a Brendan and the Brain friendship with, you know?
Yeah. And so I guess it just is always kind of falls back on this idea that Brandon is once again alone. And I was going to bring this up when you were talking about the steps, and he is very precise and very calculated, and there's no doubt that he is a very intelligent character, and he seems to be a step ahead of a lot of the people in this movie, even while he's trying to catch up to them.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a point when he wants to meet the pin that he doesn't really have a plan.
Nope.
All he wants to do is get noticed, and, you know, he does some very reckless things with Tug and Brad to just try to be visible. And I forget the pin's direct quote, but he says something like, look, you've done all this stuff and I just don't understand your motive. You want to see me and I don't know why. So kind of what's this all about?
Yep.
And yeah, to go back to that kind of ending of the movie, it's just, he's put in so much into this. He's figured everything out. We're so clueless as to this movie, as to what's going on in this movie. And as a viewer, because, you know, the dialogue's pretty heavy, they certainly don't spoon feed you the narrative to this film at all.
Yeah.
You know, it really doesn't mind leaving you in the dust a lot. And, you know, you have to pick up the pieces to try to catch up.
Yeah.
And that's what Brandon's doing the entire movie. And it's rewarding in a way, but it's also a very unsatisfying ending because he finds himself having done pretty much everything right, and he's even worse off than when he started.
Okay.
Because he now knows that he was probably the father of a child that's now dead.
Yeah.
And that's what it is to me. He's worked so hard. He's been so smart. He's gotten, you know, beat up several times and kidnapped pretty much. And, you know, he goes through all this stuff to only find himself pretty much in worse emotional shape than when the movie started. And yep. That's what that shot is to me, just giving you a chance to really digest
how bad things have got for him, despite him being very good at what he does.
Yeah, and I think that sort of ties into what I think it is that it's that's sort of where we come back to more of a teen movie trope, in that teen movies generally deal with the sort of coming of age, and I feel like that is when he's watching Laura walk away, and that's why it's very important that we see him turn away from her in the last shot. He's sort of watching... It's sort of like an Innocence Lost sort of thing. Like, he's sort of hit the point where he'll never yell, "You're the only thing I love, and this is how I do it." He'll never yell that at another person because he's hit a type of plateau on his way to adulthood, and he just sort of realizes, "Oh, this is the way the world is." And yeah, I think that's what I like about that last scene, and I think that's the best moment thematically in the movie to me. He doesn't have his shield. He doesn't have his coat. He's sort of he's prepared for this to happen now, and he's accepting of it. He doesn't necessarily like it, but that's the way it is, and he deals with it, and then he walks away and continues on with his life.
Yeah, and to tie into what you said and kind of combine it with mine, it's so important that he does turn away. And, you know, she certainly does abandon him, and, you know, he gets left behind, but he doesn't just wait there and say, "Oh, you know, maybe she'll turn around and come back." He's in this position that he didn't ask for and certainly wasn't his plan, but he's not just going to wait around and hope things get better. He's going to turn around and move on and make something else of himself.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I think it's, you know, he does get left behind, but in a way that he's not going to accept that forever. And he's not going to say, "Oh, I'm just going to wait around for things to get better. I'm going to," and that's, you know, if that's, there's a lesson in all teen heartbreak movies, it's that it's not everything always works out and you have to move on and get past it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. So Ryan Johnson,
is that it for Brick for now?
I'm sorry.
Is that it for Brick for now?
Yeah.
Again, we talked so long that we need to split up this up into two parts. So check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, where you'll be able to find part two of this podcast, which is about the Brothers Bloom. And then we get into a little bit of analysis about Rian Johnson as an auteur. So check that out.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, or follow us on Twitter @themacguffinmen.